This is Edris Wise on January the 4th, 1985, speaking to Mr. Joseph Poyes for National Council of Jewish Women Oral History Project 2. Mr. Poyes, when we were speaking the last time, we were talking about your position in the Coast Guard, and I was just getting ready to ask you your impressions of the development or what was going on with World War II, knowing where you were in the Coast Guard. Could you speak on that, please?
Yes. Fortunately, I had a chance to get some general observations because I would sit in on the staff conference, which the commandant of the Coast Guard would hold regularly, and he would, in turn, convey to us some of the more significant matters that had come up in the conference, which he, again, he attended in the Department of the Navy. In other words, he would sit in with the Secretary of the Navy, Mr. Forrestal, and from that would bring back to us a certain information. Of course, being chief of what in effect was the commandant's administrative staff, I was in a very good position to get an overall impression of how the Coast Guard functioned as a military service, and at the same time certain impressions of the total war effort. One vivid impression that I have was the tremendous mobilization of both personnel and material in connection with the war effort, and the country's ability to draw upon such vast resources. In fact, as I became more acquainted with the planning and implementation of combat operations, I realized that a great deal of our country's strength was derived from the fact that we had such vast resources, so that one might say, speaking very candidly, that even waste or imprudent use of those resources did not have the adverse effect that they would have had if we were a nation of, let us say, more modest in terms of our industrial strength, and also in terms of the human resources.
Do you think this set a pattern for the continued waste that we find now in the government? Because we were so plentiful then, we just assumed we would have it forever, and it multiplied?
It's hard for me to say whether that what we have now merely represents a continuation of what we had in World War II. My offhand reaction is that there is built into the military a tendency to overlook, let us say, the most economical approach to the utilization of resources. An attitude that is perhaps generated by the fact that you're dealing with such a vital subject as national defense. And even today, I come away with the with the feeling that that because defense has such a tremendous bearing upon the, let us say, the survivability and sense of security of the nation, that there is a strong underlying tendency to allocate resources without very, one might say, prudent and insightful consideration of the essentiality of the expenditures that are being made. Mm-hmm. In other words, I am very much concerned about the existing tendency to be somewhat uncritical so far as the general public and even government officials are concerned, to be somewhat uncritical in terms of weighing the need for certain expenditures and balancing them against the other uses that can be made for those resources.
All right. When you finished with the Coast Guard, you went back to J.L. Jacobs & Company.
Yes.
As a junior partner.
Correct.
Where the, this was from 1946 to 1947.
Correct.
Did you have any memorable, any good memories or any interesting things happen at that time that you can recall?
Well, the basic feeling I had, having come from what was a fascinating and highly stimulating experience in the Coast Guard, my basic feeling was one of considerable restlessness when I came, when I returned to J.L. Jacobs & Company as a junior partner, because most anything I did there then seemed to be relatively prosaic so far as my service in the Coast Guard, which I found fascinating, although considered most demanding. But because the Coast Guard afforded me an opportunity to work with a staff of officers of unusual capability, these were both regular officers and reserve officers, and to deal with the problems of administering a total military service, even though it was the smallest service of the military services during World War II, that proved to be so challenging and so dynamic that I found the work with J.L. Jacobs & Company quite boring.
How was it being a Jew in World War II? Did you find that you had any discrimination?
No, I never detected any religious bias. At least it was not perceptible to me. Perhaps some of that, and this is purely conjecture on my part, might have been attributed to the fact that Admiral Weishi, to whom I reported directly, certainly was an individual who seemed to be, shall I say, unreligious in his approach. And I never could feel that my being Jewish impeded the status which I had in the Coast Guard and the position of influence which I had in that service.
Mm-hmm. After you worked with J.L. Jacobs Company again, you were director of Signo Corporation?
Signo, yes.
Signo. What was that?
The Signo Corporation is a multinational corporation which basically manufactures what they call strapping, STRAPPING, which at that time was the steel band, which they place around shipments, whether they be small shipments or even coils of steel, which are very indispensable element in terms of the transportation of goods. It was headquartered in Chicago, but was multinational in scope. You might say it was a company call it the edge of the steel industry, because we used a great deal of steel, manifestly in making steel strapping, although later they also made plastic strapping, and we manufactured the tools and machines that are used in applying that strapping. I was initially employed to be the company counsel, and there I fell back upon my legal background, and the understanding was that if I demonstrated my ability, I would ultimately become the chief financial officer of the Signode Corporation, which was what did happen.
Mm-hmm. And then you worked for ECA and also the State Department in 1948 and 49. What is ECA?
Well, that was the Economic Cooperation Administration, the so-called Marshall Plan. I was just a consultant, as was the case with many of the other assignments. And I was brought down to Washington on a consulting basis to advise them in connection with setting up, I think it was the various financial controls in connection with the Economic Cooperation Administration. What was the other agency to which you
reached? State Department.
And then in the State Department, I was also brought down to Washington as a consultant in connection with, if I recall correctly, the Military Assistance Program. And again, my consultative work consisted of advising on procedures that should be set up to implement the Military Assistance Program, which was the program designed to, as the name implies, to furnish assistance to the, you might say, the military components of nations friendly to the United States.
Financial assistance.
Well, they basically, of course, the assistance could also take the form of furnishing what they call materiel. It could be weapons, it could be other armaments.
Who is responsible for getting you these jobs?
Well, let's see. I think on ECA, Donald Stone, with whom I had been associated with when I was in the consulting area, and who was in the and who is my division chief in the United States Bureau of the Budget, was the person who brought me into the ECA. My guess would be that he might have been the individual who recommended me to the Department of the State, but I'm not certain.
Word of mouth at this point was getting you good places. You also, at this time, somewhere around 1951 to 53, worked as the Director of Finance for the state of Illinois.
Yes.
Was that when Stevenson was governor?
That's correct.
And did you deal directly with him at any time?
Oh, yes. In fact, I was as Director of Finance, in effect, I was the senior officer in his cabinet. That was during the latter part of his term, and had continuing contacts with the governor, because as the Director of Finance, I was really the chief budget officer of the state, as well as advising on the overall administration of the state government. So I had a very, very close relationship with Governor Stevenson.
Can you give us some impressions of Adlai Stevenson?
Well, I suppose the best way to summarize my reaction to Adlai Stevenson was that I regard my association with him as one of the high points in my total career. I found him to be an individual of very high intellectual quality, an official of unusual integrity, and also a person who, as you perhaps know, had this brilliant ability to articulate his ideas, so that I came away as a great admirer of Adlai Stevenson, and I've always felt that it was a tragedy that a person with those qualities could have not gone further in the national political scene.
He ran for president of the United States. Why do you think he did not win?
Well, he was contending with, it seems to me, two factors. One, he was opposing a national hero, namely, of course, General Eisenhower, whose status, if you will, or his attractiveness to the American public were such that I felt nobody could really defeat General Eisenhower as our great hero from World War II. A second factor was the fact that Governor Stevenson, in addressing the American public, spoke on a relatively high intellectual level, and I do feel that even now that one cannot, if he or she wishes to be successful politically, one cannot afford to pitch their remarks at a level which is too far above the listening field. I don't want to be guilty of intellectual snobbishness, but I'm afraid that is one weakness of our existing democratic process.
In 1954, you again worked for the Defense Department of the United States.
Yeah.
In what capacity?
I was again, you know, as I said in many instances, I retained as a consultant to deal with problems which were being studied. I'm trying to recall the name of a commission that was set up to deal with the financial functions, the total financial setup of the Department of Defense. And this was a vast undertaking, namely how to strengthen the financial operations of the Defense Department. And I was one of, I guess, a number of consultants that were brought in to deal with a commission. I forget now what the commission was called, the Wilson Commission. I vaguely seem to remember that the chairman, I think, was the president, perhaps, of General Electric, but in any event, I was brought in just as one of a number of consultants.
And then you were still in Chicago at this time, I assume.
Yes.
You then became involved with the Housing and Planning Council of Metropolitan Chicago. Was this at the time they were having racial strife?
Not so much. There perhaps was some strain. It wasn't so much strife. It was at a time when this whole problem of slums and urban renewal, which of course now are activities that have moved ahead a great deal. But this was during the initial periods of attempting to clean up the slums, the dilapidated areas which we had in Chicago. We were certainly aware of the fact that there were underlying racial difficulties, but it had not reached the point which it did in recent years.
At this time, was your expertise still in organization and finance for the city of Chicago?
Well, of course, now when it said President of Metropolitan Housing Planning Council, that was, I should explain, a voluntary organization. It had no official status, but because of the prominence of individuals who were involved in it and who had established it as a very powerful civic group, it had a great deal of influence upon the city government, upon the state government. In a sense, when I say state government, it's getting legislation enacted which then permitted the implementation of urban renewal and urban rehabilitation plans. And I suppose it was my, insight into government and having both some understanding of the legal and financial aspects of it that permitted me to be as active in that organization as I was.
Who was the mayor of Chicago at this time?
Well, I'm trying to recall most of the time, and the mayor with whom I dealt was Mayor Daley, was Richard Daley. But that wasn't during the entire period, but the mayor that really sticks in my mind was Mayor Richard Daley.
Can you give us some impressions of Mayor Daley?
Very much so, because again, Mayor Daley did make quite an impression upon me, and as you know, he very frequently is referred to in connection with the political scene in Chicago, and also, shall I say, his influence in national elections, particularly in connection with the election of Mr. Kennedy as president. Mr. Daley was a member of Governor Stevenson's cabinet when I first joined it, but shortly thereafter, because he quite obviously had in mind ultimately becoming the mayor of Chicago. So shortly after I joined Governor Stevenson's cabinet, Daley, who had been serving as director of revenue, resigned to run for the office of county clerk in Cook County, which is the county which includes the city of Chicago. And subsequently, when he ran for mayor, I made the stupid blunder of supporting his Republican opponent, Mr. Merriam, who ran on a good government platform, unlike Mayor Daley. But Mayor Daley won, and I think it was very fortunate that he did win, because I did feel that the person whom I supported was not really the best qualified, even though on paper he was the reform candidate. He was the son of my mentor at the University of Chicago, Professor Merriam, and I felt that that meant that Daley and I had severed relations. I do know that Mr. Daley was very irked with me for having supported Merriam, but strangely enough, subsequently, he appointed me to the Chicago Board of Education.
What about Mr. Daley's reputation of running the Chicago machine, electoral machine? There, a lot of the publicity that he received has been adverse publicity, and some people might think that he was actually a very corrupt politician. Is this true, or what is your feeling about this?
I never felt that that Daley himself was personally corrupt, that he was amassing a great deal of wealth out of holding political office. He was a tough, outspoken, very direct individual. There was no question that he dealt with what you call the political machine, that he was deeply embedded in it, that these individuals were in many cases quite the antithesis of, let us say, the type of individuals that might have been associated with Adlai Stevenson. Daly had a certain sense of balance. Granted that and undoubtedly there were abuses, you might say, as to how the city government functioned, but he maintained a type of city government which on the whole was not bad. That one thing about him, he was very down to earth. Because of his influence with the unions, you didn't have much labor difficulty. And considering the situation at the time, I couldn't help but develop a certain liking for him. In my dealings with him, I found him very much, very direct, never engaged in double talk, and I was always impressed with the fact that having appointed me to the Board of Education, despite what I had done to him when he was originally running for mayor, he never really held it against me. He never asked for any favor of me while I was serving on the Board of Education. And in fact, occasionally when he was scheduled to speak on the problems of the schools and could not make it, he would ask me to speak in his place. Now, this did not mean that he did everything that, let's say, when I was president of the Metropolitan Housing and Planning Council, I would have liked the mayor to do. But the point was, he never engaged in subterfuge. He was always direct in his approach. He was a very forceful individual. And if one considers the time, the circumstances that existed in Chicago at that particular period of time, I must say, on balance, I was not at all disappointed in having him as mayor.
What were some of the issues that you had to deal with as a member of the Chicago School Board? You were a member of the Chicago School Board from 1956 to 61.
That's correct.
Maybe we should just split the tape.
Fine.
Because it's almost at the end.
Okay.
We have 3 minutes.
Is this going
on?